babushkas working at Moscow's museums were quick to reprimand anyone who tried to take pictures without paying extra for a photography pass. There was a permission slip for everything, I discovered. If you wanted to swim in one of Moscow's pools, you first needed to visit a doctor. Every pool seemed to have its own one-man clinic for this purpose, and pay to be examined as proof that you were not contagious with some kind of disease. So that's Sarah Zuckerman. She's the protagonist of Elliot Holt's debut novel, You Are One of Them. I read this book about a month ago and was very delighted, not just by the vivid portrayal of Moscow life that's there with the babushkas and that is actually going to be checked in this following conversation, but also by the way that Sarah Zuckerman, who has come to Moscow to investigate the mysterious disappearance of her childhood friend Jennifer Jones, well, she takes in the sights with this kind of introverted, particular sensibility you don't often see in novels of this type. So, of course, I read the book and I said, heck, I'm going to have talk with her. So we talked for about an hour, and this introduction is also an announcement that the Bat Segundo show, which I had retired 8 months ago and kind of brought back a little bit with the Jack Butler conversation, has now returned. It's going to be a weekly operation. We're going to have a new show every Tuesday, and I'm going to get into the nitty-gritty about that scheduling in just a little bit. I wanted to first of all explain why I came back. There's a number of reasons. A number of author friends had shared countless horror stories with me about how there were interviewers out there who weren't reading their books. They wanted to go ahead and pry into every needless personal detail. Suddenly, you have the literary author in this kind of TMZ format. And some of these interviewers, I had learned, were boorish, illiterate, humorless, grim, opportunistic. So I felt some responsibility to come back, because if you can't read the book that someone has toiled on for years of their life and they're sitting in front of you, what's the point of having a conversation? And I should also point out that the idea of constantly churning out shows doesn't appeal to me. So I am also going to be very careful about who I have on the program. I'm also going to be carrying on with Follow Your Ears. I was going to go ahead and do that, but the issue there was that one episode of Follow Your Ears takes me about 3 weeks to make. I learned this the hard way. So here's what we're going to do. Every Tuesday, you're going to get a new show. The last Tuesday of every month, we're going to have a brand new Follow Your Ears show. And for the other weeks, we're going to have a Bat Segundo show. That way, anybody subscribing to this feed gets a regular show, there's a little variety, and I also don't get burned out. If you go to batsegundo.com, that's B-A-T-S-E-G-U-N-D-O, you'll see that we have redesigned the site. You can now find all the shows there. If you scroll down, it's all neatly laid out. It looks a lot better on your phone and your tablet. I had maintained a design that was the finest website design that 2004 had to offer. We have changed that, so please feel free, listen to those shows, and spread the word. I'm committed to keeping the show going as long as I can, and it's going to count very much on what you can do. I think that all of us can come together to create more substantive talk that is fun, that is intelligent. And that also goes into interesting associative waters, which my conversation with Elliot certainly did. I'm also welcoming your input for this new incarnation of Bat Segundo. So please leave comments. If you would like to get me to read something on the air, or if you have some comments, I'd be happy to talk back to you with email. You can email me at ed@edrants.com. But for now, here's my conversation with the lovely and illustrious Elliot Holt. Enjoy. Okay, so I'm here with Elliot Holt, who is most recently the author of You Are One of Them. Elliot, you are here. How are you doing?
I'm fine. You know, it's funny. I haven't figured out how to say the title of my book.
Because you don't know what emphasis to place on?
Yeah, I like the way it can be, you know, you are one of them, or you are one of them.
You are one of them, or you are one
right,
of them.
Or sort of
you
a realization, like, you are one of them, huh. You know.
Have you had any discussions with your publicist about this most pressing issue?
No,
the title,
like,
is very important, you know?
I know, but I think this is my, you know, that's what I like about the title. It's from an Elizabeth Bishop poem, and I, in the poem, I've always heard it, you are one of them. So I guess that's, but Anyway, this is neither here nor there.
Well, absolutely. And Elizabeth Bishop is rolling in her grave as we speak.
I hope she isn't, actually.
Yes, they're discussing the intonations of one line for a much larger purpose.
I hope she is grateful because I love her work so much.
Well, I want to get into the book in a little bit, but actually I wanted to ask you because I did some research and found that you had gone to ACT in San Francisco.
Yeah,
you actually
how did you find that?
Oh, I have my ways. Oh, and this is interesting. So you had an acting career at some point.
I did.
Roughly at the time that I was there, and I was making these little short films and plays.
Funny.
And I'm like wondering why we didn't actually run into each other.
That's so funny. I did go to ACT in San Francisco. I was a drama major in college. I went to Kenyon. I was in lots and lots of plays.
That explains why all your answers are in iambic pentameter.
Yeah. No, I was in a lot of plays in college, and I wrote some plays in college. They were terrible.
Really?
But I think because I took playwriting and read a lot of, you know, I read Aristotle's Poetics, and I read a lot of plays by Pinter and Beckett and Mamet, and I think I was a terrible playwright. I thought I would like playwriting because I had been writing fiction since I was a little kid, and one of the things I always liked about fiction writing was dialogue, and so I thought that because I liked to write dialogue, it would be fun to write plays.
Were any of your plays performed?
Well, my two best friends from college and I, they actually are playwrights. They're really good playwrights. They're working playwrights. But when we were in college, we had a kind of student theater group, and we sort of staged our own short plays in this kind of black box theater. I never wrote any, or I never staged any full-length things. I did some scenes I wrote. But anyway, the point is, I was actually a terrible playwright, but I think reading all those plays helped my fiction writing, because I think I have a really strong sense of subtext and just of the importance of scenes as opposed to just interiority. So I think it helped me as a fiction writer, but I was a really bad playwright.
Do you still have any kind of performance quality when you are conjuring up a scene or getting in the head, in this case, of Sarah Zuckerman? I mean, did you feel
you mean when I'm writing?
When you're writing, or do you have to perform sometimes to kind of pinpoint her voice?
No, I don't perform. I do think that when I'm writing, it's not so different from when I was acting in the sense that I'm really imagining my way into the head of someone. But I don't, it's not like I read things aloud. I mean, I think as a reader, I think I have a good ear as a reader. And I am very sensitive to modulations in tone when I'm reading fiction. And so I think I do hear the language when I'm writing, but I'm not reading it out loud. I mean, later when I have a full draft, I'll read it out loud to sort of hear the spots that I think need work. But
do you read the whole book? Because Laura Lippman, I know, does that too.
Yeah. And it helps. You really hear the weak sentences. But no, not while I'm writing. I'm not performing anything. I do think in terms of scenes, and I'm sure that's because I've read a lot of plays.
Well, since you have very kindly stepped into the fray of this kind of revived Bat Segundo, I'm going to have to give you one of these massive Bat Segundo questions on your book, which I very much enjoyed. So this book reminded me very much of two specific masterpieces. Philip Roth's The Ghostwriter, of course, because we have Nathan
Zuckerman,
Sarah Zuckerman. But not just that, but also the whole thing with Jennifer Jones reminded me of that Anne Frank situation in The Ghostwriter.
Oh, that's so funny. I didn't even...
And then, of course, I have to ask you about Billy Wilder's masterpiece, 1-2-3, especially since Coca-Cola is here and you've got the whole Russian thing.
So funny.
And I'm wondering, you know, do you need to have partial narrative frameworks, like in this case, The Ghostwriter or 1-2-3, possibly, in order to kind of pinpoint Sarah's life in this case? Because there's a good chunk of the midsection where it's pretty much Sarah just kind of thinking and we're in her head, and then we go back to the plot. So it's almost like sometimes you adopt narrative frameworks with which to provide Sarah some momentum and with which to provide the reader a good sense of steering the life along a kind of track, and then it kind of dissembles and then it kind of reattaches again. And I'm really curious about yes, absolutely. So I'm curious first of all, were these two masterpieces inspiration for you?
They weren't.
Not
because
at all?
I've never seen 1-2-3.
You have not seen 1-2-3.
No.
It's Jimmy Cagney.
I've never seen it. And I love Billy Wilder.
Oh my
but
God.
I've never seen 1-2-3.
This moves as like a machine gun pace. And it's like, it has like Coca-Cola and Soviet relations.
No,
And paternal stuff, where there's a lot of paternal stuff in this.
No, I've never seen it. And actually, I think I read The Ghostwriter in college, but I love Philip Roth, but I haven't read The Ghostwriter in a long time. I mean, my favorite, the Roth books that I love the most are American Pastoral and The Human Stain, and and I love Portnoy's. It's like such a great first book. But no, I wasn't conscious of. I think on some intuitive level, I knew I was playing games by naming her Zuckerman.
Yeah.
In a sort of Roth thing, but I wasn't thinking about the ghostwriter. What I was thinking about in terms of. I didn't have like conscious narrative frame. I mean, I was inspired by Samantha Smith. Mm-hmm. So I had a kind of historical, I had history to play with, so I had some history as a frame. And I think otherwise, no, I didn't, it wasn't like there was a conscious frame I was working towards.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to give too much away, but to me, this is a book about history, personal and cultural, and the obsessive nature of grief. And I think this is a narrator who, has a kind of fantasy about doing her past over or getting to see this person she hasn't seen in a long time. And she's really susceptible to a lot of things when she gets to the former Soviet Union because there are things she wants to believe. And so she gets kind of caught up in her own little spy story in her mind for a while.
Well, I wanted to talk about...
because she kind of, it's like that's her association with Russia and she wants to...
Sure. Well, on that subject, I was really keen to talk with you about the way you capture Sarah's introverted nature, which is a little different from other books because it's almost as if we can get inside her social reservations by way of what she observes in Moscow and the very specific details. It's almost as if that exists as a way for you to not necessarily inhabit the full nature of her head. She's taking things in. She's trying to actually figure out how this relates to her own identity and how this relates to Jennifer Jones, this girlhood friend who has disappeared. She's trying to go ahead and make complete sense of this, but she's doing so by merely bouncing off of the sights that she observes in the, in the regular world. And I'm wondering, did you feel that you wanted to avoid this kind of almost interior monologue or descent into someone's head? Because, most of the time when we read an introvert in fiction, especially not in, say, A.L. Kennedy novels, we're totally inside that head, which is fine. But in your case, you don't always go there. And in fact, we don't actually see what becomes of her until very late in the game when we see some more present-day memories or aspects of her life that are then featured later. And I wanted to ask you about this.
Well, I don't think it's a conscious decision. I just think, I probably write the way I do because of the kind of writers I love to read. So, Chekhov did exactly that. You have a sense of the character more from what the character is observing than from anything else. And I think this is the other thing about this book is that this is Sarah's a character who spent her life thinking of herself as a footnote in someone else's story, kind of playing martyr, and this is finally, in this book, this is when she finally tells her story herself, but she's not the most reliable narrator. She is still evasive in some ways. I guess what I'm saying is it's, for me, a pretty intuitive process. So it's not like I thought, okay, this is a character whose introvertedness is only going to be revealed by what she observes. I think it's just the way I write,
Sure.
And again, I think it's probably more to do with the kind of books that I love most.
I wanted to discuss the advertising angle, and I want to do so through a very interesting vantage point. I read a story in the New York Times recently that fascinated me, where you have these tunnels which were formerly used to smuggle guns into Gaza, right? And now they're being used to smuggle KFC meals.
Yeah,
like it's like this
so,
4-hour delivery of guys with like soggy fries and chicken, and they're waiting for it in Gaza, right? And
that is amazing.
And this leads me to ask about, Czar Soda in this, which is an effort to actually hook the Russians on Coca-Cola, which is interesting. You should see 1-2-3 because that's also Jimmy Cagney's idea. He wants to hook the Russians on Coca-Cola in that.
I've never seen that. You know, but it's funny because I love Dr. Strangelove.
Yes.
And there's that great scene in Dr. Strangelove when, you know, Peter Sellers plays three characters in that film. So it's his...
You're going to have to answer the Coca-Cola company.
Yes. I love that scene. And I love... it's so brilliant and funny because that tension between, you know, the private powers, the corporations, and the government powers is fascinating to me. And so, and it certainly was something I was thinking about all the time when I lived in Moscow, because when, after the Soviet Union fell, there was this sort of vacuum. And you know, when I was living there, Yeltsin was perceived as kind of weak and all these oligarchs were taking over. And there was a sense that, you know, the superpowers had been replaced by these corporate entities. Anyway, I completely interrupted
your
question.
No, it's totally fine. I love tangential stuff. But anyway, you have this tunnel underneath the Russian embassy.
Yeah.
The Americans are digging this tunnel. And what's also...
The Americans are digging a tunnel, exactly.
Yes. And what's also interesting is that you do actually name check Yeltsin's truth decree, where he basically said in January 1994, we will not have advertising that tells lies, basically. So, I'm going to make an effort to take all these stray points and get you to talk about the notion of, you know, you have here in Gaza a nation that is in decline and inevitably goes to KFC. You have in the Soviet Union a nation that was going through some struggle and then is starting to get hooked on soda. So, what are your thoughts on this idea of any kind of nation, no matter where they are, seems to be inevitably hooked in some way upon a kind of influx or smuggling of Western advertising. And I'm wondering, to what degree was this a concern when you were writing You Are One of Them?
Well, I don't know about hooked, but I will say, I guess what I was thinking more about is not so much getting hooked on advertising, but on the way that advertising... corporate advertising is not so different from propaganda that governments use, in the sense that you need an us versus them mentality in order to sell your message. So it's like Coke versus Pepsi, the Soviet Union versus United States.
Us versus them.
Yeah. There's this, you know, you sort of need to kind of create an enemy in order to define yourself. It's like, so, it just seemed to me a kind of funny, I mean, it actually makes me laugh. Cold War, Cola Wars. It just makes me chuckle.
But Svetlana does memorize slogans, commits them to memory. So it's almost as if here's the last little piece of information I could grab to try to get ahead in this shaky economy. You know?
Well, I mean, I worked in an ad agency
in
Moscow, and I was the only American in the creative department. The creative director was an expat, but all the creatives besides me were Russians, and
they called it creatives in Moscow.
That's what they do at all ad agencies. You're the creatives, quote unquote.
Yeah.
And this was an American ad agency, so the management were all expats, but most of the staff were Russian, and so I had these Russian colleagues and friends who had worked in other fields and were suddenly doing this because they could make a lot more money but they were trained as, there's one fine artist who was suddenly an art director and, architects and whoever, and they're just suddenly they're working for this ad agency. And it's hilarious just because when they were growing up, the only Aeroflot would have billboards, I think, but otherwise, there was no sort of culture of advertising. And it was amazing to me, how quickly they just sort of got into the lingo.
Yeah.
But also, it was strangely depressing because there was not even depressing, just I love things that are absurd. And one of the things that was totally absurd is there was this campaign. I had nothing to do with this. I was just sort of watching it all unfold because there were other American agencies there too. But there was a campaign for... there's an old cigarette brand in Russia. It's sort of a pre-revolutionary brand called Yava, and there's been a factory in Moscow forever. And British American Tobacco bought Yava. They bought the factory. They bought the brand, and they repackaged it as Yava Zolotaya, which translates as Yava Gold. And they put the cigarettes in this like shiny gold packaging. And improve the quality of the tobacco, and they wanted to position it as kind of Western quality tobacco, but in, you know, like a Russian brand, because they had done research that showed people were sort of feeling like there was economic imperialism, and they resented the fact that, you know, all these Western brands had kind of marched in and were taking over. So, you know, very smart. And the ad agency came up with a campaign. The tagline sort of translated, the closest translation would be like "strike back." And they had all these huge billboards all over Moscow that were using essentially like Cold War iconography to sell the cigarette brand. So there, the first one was like a an American space shuttle, you know, in space, and then you can see these Russian cosmonauts painting their flag onto the thing, and they were very funny, you know.
Yeah.
And it said "strike back," and it was hugely successful, and all these people were buying Yava Zolotaya, but of course none of them knew that it was actually owned by British American Tobacco, and that that was a, you know, they were essentially giving their money to a foreign company without knowing it. So there was this kind of Russian pride.
Yeah.
Well, anyway.
It seems like they were trading one form of propaganda for another.
Right. Yeah. Well, and also I think what also interested me is that, you know, a lot of Americans are like, well, the Russians had nothing but propaganda. I'm like, you don't think we have propaganda?
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is an interesting point, because I wanted to actually touch upon one arc of your book, and I'm going to do my best not to give it away.
Yeah.
But let's just say that a particular character enters by way of focus group and exits by way of being identified by a brand. Which leads me to wonder, again, about why the characters in this book are very often defined almost by advertising as a kind of the only identity they have left, the only diplomatic conduit for Soviet-American relations.
Yeah. Well, when you say she exits by way of a brand, what do you mean?
Basically, she's...
You mean her last glimpse of her is in her Adidas
tracksuit? The last glimpse is searching for a particular branding.
Yes.
Yeah, like I said, I'm trying not to give it away.
I was like, I'm so confused.
No. In fact, it is early in the morning. This is very sort of last minute of the improv.
Very early in the morning. In my defense, I don't always sound so confused. Yes, but I think also, I think this idea of being branded isn't just in the parts of the book set in Russia. I mean, I think that's a theme that I was playing with in the whole book, because when Sarah and Jenny are little girls, you know, Jenny becomes famous as this child ambassador and is kind of branded a particular way.
Yes.
And Sarah is aware of that and conscious of that even when they're young. I mean, her mother basically says to her, look, she's good for the cause. Like, they've, you know, the reason she got a response, the reason they invited her, she just sort of looks the part, like she, you know, and which is, you know, I think a kind of nuts thing to say to a 10-year-old, like,
yeah,
basically, like, don't worry about it. It's just sometimes image matters a lot, and this person has the image that they need. So there, you know, I think this idea of how people are positioned and sold and branded is there all along, you know. And so of course Sarah is going to start to see things that way when she, you know, was aware of that, you know. I mean, DC is the capital of spin, so
yes, but it's I think it's more than just DC, because Sarah sees this letter of hers appropriated by her childhood friend Jennifer, and then this foundation springs up all around that, which mm-hmm. leads me to again ask you, I'm really curious how these characters are all defined by whether they can be trusted, whether they are victims of some kind of capitalist advertising identity that invades your pores and makes you incapable of being human, and incapable also of like really exploring the wonderful world of Moscow, as decrepit as it is. I actually was like getting sort of like, hey, I really kind of want to go there, and I want to see all the crosswalk underneath the streets and all that, all those tunnels and all the crazy cabs, things
Moscow.
Like that. Was one of the focuses of building Sarah based on this notion of just wanting to, or maybe in your efforts to kind of deepen her identity, were you just kind of running up against this idea of being defined by capitalism and advertising? And
I mean, again, I wasn't consciously thinking about those themes, certainly not in like first drafts. I mean, I just don't work that way. I work very intuitively, and I work kind of on the character level. And then it's only when I'm sort of, when I back up and I see larger themes, then I'll maybe start to pull them out. So I wasn't thinking in terms of capitalism and communism, but I was, you know, I was thinking in terms of like image and the way people are seen and what's projected onto them. And I think, you know, I was also playing with a lot of dichotomies. I mean, in this book, there are so many dichotomies. There are dogs and cats. There are Republicans and Democrats. There are, you know, Russians and Americans. There are, you know, lies and truth. I mean, there are all these dichotomies, and you know, there's this world in which Sarah is, you know, where things are presented to her in these kind of poles, you know, and I think that, you know, we'll see when more people have read the book if they think I've actually succeeded in doing this, and I'm sure people will say no. But I mean, one of the things that I was thinking a lot about is that, you know, not only is this a story, this is the moment when Sarah finally tells her own story, as opposed to just letting, you know, playing martyr and being, you know, the footnote in someone else's story, but it's also finally a moment in which she kind of rejects the dichotomies and is sort of like okay with ambiguity, or you know what I mean? She sort of chooses to not define everything in black and white, if you know what I mean.
Let me rephrase this idea, because I do want to see if I can get more from you on this point. In your personal view, do you feel that any kind of internal effort to map our own identity is going to immediately be obstructed by our relationship to how we are defined, often against our will, by advertising, by capitalist forces, and all that? I mean, why is that such a thing for Sarah? It's, at least that's the takeaway I got.
I don't see it that way. I mean, I don't think she, I really didn't think about it that way, that she sees herself as defined by capitalism and advertising. And no, I just think, you know, the landscape of the world she grew up in as a child, you know, the 80s were so ostentatious. And
well, that was certainly driven by capitalism advertising.
Right. Yeah. So, of course, you know, yes, there are certain brands. And but I don't think her entire internal identity is mapped by those things. I just think it's, you know, she's aware of it, you know, in the way that.
But I would argue that Sarah is very aware that someone is listening to her story. And I'm curious about that, because typically if we describe our life to a friend, mm-hmm. or we describe our life to a therapist, we often just spill it all out without any kind of attachment to time and place. So I'll tell you about something that happened 2 years ago, then I'll get into 20 years ago, then I'll get into 10 years ago, and so forth. But in the case of Sarah, as I intimated earlier, late in the book, she's starting to, with this guy who has she's been with, she's starting to kind of see connections that are more close, that are closer to the present. And I'm wondering why you felt Sarah had to tell her story this way. It doesn't seem to me necessarily a wanting to adhere to narrative. It could be a situation where maybe Sarah needs to earn a person's trust before you know more about her now. And there's still plenty we don't know about her now. I'm wondering why there was almost this kind of linearity in the way she told her story like that.
Well, I think, you know, it's funny you said this isn't the way someone would tell a story to a friend or to a therapist. But, you know, first-person fiction with a first-person narrator, you have to sort of ask, like, well, who is the narrator talking to, right? And I think in this case, again, this is like her putting down on the record what was never on the record before. So in my mind, she's not just talking to a friend. She's packaging her own story for a much bigger audience.
You know what
I mean? This is the interview she never got to do. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like she never got to tell her version of the story. So this is not confiding in one person. This is, she's telling the story to a much bigger audience. And in that sense, she's spinning it the way anyone spins any story. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think, I think, but I also, again, like I'm not, I think I still, I operate on a much more intuitive level than your question suggests. Like, it's not like, okay, now there's going to be a shift into the, I mean, I love Alice Munro. I love her stories and I love the way she has these kind of shifts in time. They're very instructive to me. I mean, it's something that I'm playing with more and more in my own work. And I think, again, it's just very intuitive to me that a character would sort of make some kind of weird connection in a moment and then flash forward or flash back to something that reminds her of that. I mean,
well, that's a totally human moment, regardless of whether it's fiction or a conversation or some other form of telling a story.
Right.
But what's interesting is that happens much later. And if she is spinning her own story, I mean, you know, how early into the process of writing this book did you know that she was a coy, subtle, quiet?
But I think coy isn't the right word. I just think, you know, when human beings tell stories, they do usually start at the beginning.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and...
I am an American Chicago born.
Right. So this is, it's linear because, you know, most stories are linear. But then, you know, there are a couple of places where it's not linear. But I don't think, you know, it's not like, oh, I thought, oh, she's coy. I just think that she's complicated. You know, she's, she, on the one hand, resents the fact that, you know, she got sort of left and never got to tell the story. On the other hand, you know, I don't know. She's not, she's sort of aware of the fact that she wouldn't have been as open, you know, as her friend was. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's a pretty, like, the form that the narrative takes was a pretty intuitive choice, I guess.
I have one of my most important questions of this morning is this. Do you hate the Eagles?
I really do hate the Eagles.
Really do. I do too, actually.
I really hate the Eagles.
Yeah.
And I really did hear Hotel California so often when I lived in Moscow because I think it is, you know, it's one of those ubiquitous songs. You just hear it everywhere in Eastern Europe. And I think a lot of people are like, oh, it's such an American song because it's California. And I just hate that song so much. And I met people who, you know, were always singing it or, you know, learning to play it on the guitar. And I thought, oh, God, we have such good music coming out of the United States. Please don't play this.
When I was a teenager and I had a guitar, I made a conscious effort not to learn any Eagles songs. I had a few requests.
I mean, I think it's an easy song on the guitar, maybe. So, but plenty of room in the Hotel California. You know, it's like,
and then there's the
God.
Big Lebowski's use of it, too.
I forgot that. Yeah, but anyway.
Which actually, that's actually a good, weirdly enough, a good cover version.
Right.
Why do you think Hotel California is such
because
a defining...
Because California.
Yeah.
California is... You know, I think a lot of people who are not in the U.S., when they think of the United States, they think California. I mean, partly it's Hollywood's been exported, but also it's just, you know, especially if you're in Eastern Europe and snow and, you know, the idea of palm trees. And it's a very attractive...
You've got 4 hours of daylight. Ooh, sunshine!
Totally. It's a very attractive idea. Very attractive. California. But,
Are you preparing the Russian dialect for on tour?
Well, I've been known to do Russian accents for many years.
Oh, yeah. What's your best Natasha?
Oh,
I can be Boris. You can be Natasha.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, my Russian teacher always used to say, I used to love, I would walk around Moscow with her and she'd say, this is very old George. This is George. And I was like, oh, I love the way you say church. George.
Yeah. George.
George.
I've often felt that I should rename myself George when I have...
No, but you're saying church.
I know. When I've entered a church, I mean.
Yeah. George. No, I love Russia. I do. It's just... where was I? Oh, yeah. So I don't like the Eagles. But I can understand why Hotel California has become this kind of exported representation of this day.
So, I mean, how long were you in Moscow?
I lived there. Well, the first time I visited was in 1993, and then went back for a couple weeks in 1996, and then I moved there in 97, and then I was there for 2 years.
But you kept coming back for sunshine in the States.
Well, I mean, my mother moved there in 96 and lived there for 4 years. And so my sisters and I, when she moved there, she worked for the World Bank. When she moved there, I'm the oldest of three sisters. My middle sister and I were in college, and the youngest sister was in boarding school. And so we spent, you know, that's where we went for Christmas vacation. We flew to Moscow.
And did your mother?
To Moscow for the holidays.
There's one character who says that her mother actually adapted surprisingly well to Russian life. Was that your mother too? Or?
No, no. She adapted in the sense that she was a very, she was a very adventurous person who'd like spent her life trotting around the globe and was, you know, very successful at her career, but she, you know, she was fine because she could sort of, but she didn't learn to speak Russian. I mean, she understood a lot, but she didn't speak it very well. And she, I wouldn't say she, you know, necessarily sort of embraced Russian life. She loved her job and she loved her colleagues, but,
Oh, no worries.
But no, yeah, she wasn't like, yay, now I'm Russian, you know.
So at one point, Sarah rattles off the Moscow rules.
Yeah.
And this is this informal set of regulations that, you know, the operatives used during the Cold War, what to do in Moscow. What's interesting is that Sarah recites in the exact same order and word by word the version that is now in place at the International Spy Museum.
Right, right, right.
And I'm wondering why you didn't feel Sarah should stray from this in light of the fact that she strays from details all the time.
But that I think of this book as almost like her, you know, she's got her little Jenny files and she's got her almost like a scrapbook. And so I think to me parts of this book are sort of almost like parts of her scrapbook, which like here's a list of things that people, all those interviewers don't know about Jenny, and here's a list of the Moscow rules. And she's not telling this. It's not a conversation. It's like she's put this down.
So. But there are many versions of the Moscow.
Yeah, rules. Anyway. But
did you step foot in the International Spy Museum?
Oh, yeah, I've been there many times.
Okay, did you do research for this?
I did.
Oh, really?
I did.
I'm wondering, I mean, are you the kind of novelist who does a good chunk of research and wants to figure out a way to use all of it in the book? Or
No.
Okay.
I use what I need, you know?
Yeah.
I use what serves the story. I don't feel beholden to the research, if you know what I mean. Like, I don't... You have to let the history get out of the way.
How did you stumble upon the whole bracketed ellipse version in which to almost transcribe the international call?
I don't know. I just... That's something I played with a few years ago when I was writing something else, and I just... I don't know. It's just, again, like a very intuitive choice, but I was very frustrated when I would make international calls in that... That weird gap that breaks up the conversation, and I was trying to figure out how to
visualize it,
or not even just visualize it, but how to make it work on the page so that when you're reading it, you would have the same fractured, you know, it would stop you the same way it stops you in real conversation. So I just, you know, that just that punctuation just seemed to me the closest approximation of the experience of having it broken that way. So.
Sarah has designs on being a journalist at some point, and there is this kind of terrifying opposite of the NPR reporter who's dabbling in all sorts of superficial issues. This leads me to wonder, I mean, what is your present or possibly past relationship to journalism? I mean, did you feel the need to go for that whole nuts and bolts approach either in fiction or in nonfiction writing at any point in your life?
I've never had a desire to be a journalist. You know, I respect great journalism a lot. And I think, you know, again, I grew up in D.C. where, because in the wake of Watergate, I think there was a sense that journalists were heroes, you know, sort of Woodward and Bernstein. And you know, this was really the heyday of the Washington Post, was in my childhood. So I certainly think I grew up in an era of reverence for journalists.
Now it's the most dangerous occupation.
Yeah. Well, and it, you know, it
more than lumberjacks.
It's certainly dangerous in Russia. So, you know, and I feel very strongly about freedom of the press and everything. So, I mean, but I've never had any urge to be a reporter. It just doesn't, you know, I don't really want to write nonfiction.
No problem.
It's not my thing.
Jade at one point says, it's hard for us to build diplomacy with Russia while everyone's still holding on to those Hollywood cliches. Mm-hmm. Going back to what I was trying to get at earlier, I mean, how much of Russia do you feel is defined by either cliches ascribed to them by outside forces or cliches they're still in the process of embedding?
Well, I don't even think it's just Russia. I think lots of... I mean, I think, you know, people who haven't been to the United States have ascribe certain cliches to, I mean, they just sort of, when they think America, they think Hollywood. They think, you know, there are certain things that just pop into their mind first. And I don't know about people who are, you know, quite a bit younger than I am, but I certainly think people my age and a little older who remember the last years of the Cold War, they probably still, when you say Russia to them, they're honestly probably the first things that are going to pop into their head are like KGB and, you know, because we just spent so much of our childhood hearing about the CIA versus the KGB and these, you know, summits between the Soviets and the Americans. And so these associations are hard to shake. And so it's not so much that I think they're actually defined that way. But I think, again, what I was saying is that, you know, Sarah comes to Russia with these, there's a Russia of her imagination and she is served that, you know, Svetlana it gives her exactly what she's sort of expecting to see.
On that note, what is the first word that pops in your head when I say Russia to you?
Well, actually Moscow, but that's just because it was my home, you know?
Yeah.
And there's so, and
California, Sacramento.
Yeah.
England, London.
Well, no, I mean, yeah, you say England, I think London, you say California, I think Los Angeles.
Yeah.
You know, it's not the capital, but it's like the first, but Moscow is,
pub
know,
quizzes then.
Exactly. So different from the rest of Russia. And, you know, it's like saying, you know, New York represents the United States. I mean, it's just, it's, you know, a big, complicated, amazing city, and its own kind of universe in the way that all great cities are. So,
my understanding is that you have taken an author photograph of Rafe Larson, and I was wondering,
Rafe Larson.
Rafe Larson, I'm sorry, and I'm wondering if you had any sort of Marion Edlinger kind of aspirations or author photo you're sitting on.
No. I took his author photo because he's married to my sister.
That's right.
So, and I used to do a lot of photography in high school, and I, you know, I enjoy taking pictures sometimes, but honestly, I think he just thought, hey, why don't, if you want to take it, then, you know, then he didn't have to pay someone to take it, so.
How many times did you go to Propaganda when you were in Moscow, and when was the last time you went there?
Oh, well, the last time I was in Moscow was in 2001, I think. So I haven't been there in so long. I'm dying to go back, but I didn't want to go back till I was done with this book because I did not want my very clear memories of Moscow in the 90s to be, you know, kind of distorted by contemporary Moscow, which is so different. I mean, so much has changed. So
you'd feel they would get in the way of either furthering your own particular imagined version of Moscow?
Or? Yeah, but also, really, it's so much more westernized now, and it's so much more, I mean, there was no middle class when I lived there, and there really is now in Moscow. And so, you know, now there are Starbucks, you know, now there's a kind of fancy train you can take straight from the airport into the city, you know, which there was not, certainly not. So it's just, it's really different. There are, like, cafes everywhere. You know, it's much more... it's much more like any sort of Western city. And my sister, my younger sister, was there for most of 2011 doing dissertation research. And so I would Skype with her and, you know, she would tell me about how much had changed because, you know, she also went there for the first time in 96. So she'd sort of seen it evolve. And I kind of couldn't get over, and she would send me pictures. And, you know, I had a sense of how much it was changing. But I just, yeah, I didn't want to go there because... I needed my remembered version.
Well, what about Propaganda? How many times did you hit that place? Or did you?
There really is a nightclub called Propaganda.
Yes, I
don't
know
if it's still there.
It is, believe it or not.
Oh, it is?
Yeah,
funny. How many times did I go? I don't know, 20 maybe. It's not quite the way I described it in the book, but
it became more of an expat place for your purposes, or?
No, there were a lot of expats when I was there, but there were all these just crazy sort of conceptual restaurants and night spots in the 90s, there's almost a Vegas quality to Moscow, you know, where everything's just like so over the top. But there was one place I remember, I cannot remember what it was called, that had these kind of huge fish tanks with naked men swimming in them. You know, I mean, it's just like completely insane. And we were just these sort of ridiculous.
Sort of like Cirque du Soleil.
Kind of.
Except like, on the other side.
But really, there are parts of it that just feel like Vegas, where you're like, wait, what? And everything's open all night. And, in that sense, it's a little bit like New York. It's a city that does not sleep. And the nightlife is totally crazy, totally crazy. Yeah.
Well, I also wanted to discuss the issue of cleanliness in your book. You describe how the Russians are sort of bemused by Americans who are obsessed with cleanliness. And then you have this extremely bizarre situation where Sarah goes to the swimming pool and she constantly has to show that she's cleaned her crotch. Wow. I mean, I'd never heard anything about this.
That's true.
Wow, crazy. Yeah, though she's wearing a swimsuit and all that stuff.
The babushki will like come up to you in the shower and make sure you've like scrubbed yourself.
Yeah, wow. Is it limited only to foreigners, or do they do that with everybody?
I would imagine it's probably just to foreigners, just because I think probably the Russian women would know already to scrub themselves so thoroughly that, you know what I mean?
Give you shit and humiliate you.
Well, there's just a lot of babushki, just means old woman. The older women in Russia are very, they're kind of, they're just bossy, and they're always telling you, how to do things, you're always being sort of reprimanded for something. And there's a lot of Russian is full of proverbs and folk wisdom. And there's a lot of sort of, lessons like you should this, you should that, you should this. You know? So
what's the biggest lesson you took from Russia?
Oh God.
Any babushki axioms that we could spread on to the American listeners?
There's so much. They're just, it's a very superstitious culture. It's like Eastern in that sense. And, so it's a lot of, I can't even remember all the superstitions, but you just, it's funny because like, for example, it's not bad luck to open an umbrella inside there, unlike here, but then there are all these other things that are terrible luck. There's something about like, is there something about like a mirror, when you look in a mirror right before you leave your house or something? Anyway, the point is I could hardly keep up with all the like, oh no, you shouldn't do that. Oh no, that's really bad luck. It's very...
Do they shift on a day-to-day basis?
No, they don't shift on a day-to-day basis, but it's funny because it's just a much more superstitious culture than here. And it's Eastern in that sense, it's...
Do you think that sort of superstitious impulse is what has allowed Russia to survive? And is there anything we can kind of take away from that in any kind of mystical way here in our country or somewhere else?
We're
getting
into
deep, profound waters.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I mean, I don't know. But it is true that there's a kind of mystical quality. I mean, there are many things I love about Russia. One is that literature is totally revered. Writers are revered. I mean, there are statues of writers in parks. You can't even imagine. And even before I could speak Russian, I wanted so badly to be able to read Chekhov without translation and Tolstoy. And luckily, Chekhov's and Tolstoy's language are both pretty straightforward on the sentence level. So, that's sort of feasible, whereas Dostoevsky, I don't think I'll ever be able to read any Dostoevsky in Russian, because it's very complicated and convoluted.
You're not a Dostoevsky fan?
I know, I like Dostoevsky, but I'm just saying on the sentence level, his writing is just as complicated in Russian. Like the vocabulary and the grammar, it's much more complicated. So I love the literature, and it's true. I also I love the Russian notion of dusha, which is soul. They talk about it a lot. And I think they really, my Russian friends were always saying to me, that foreigners could never really understand the Russian soul. It's much deeper and more profound and mysterious than anything, which is, of course, kind of insulting when you're basically, when someone's saying to you, like, your soul is not a Russian soul. You don't have,
Quit trying.
I know. Sorry.
Even if you can read Dostoevsky without problems.
I mean, you know, I think probably there's a perception that a lot of Americans are sort of shallow and superficial and only care about shopping and brands. And
how did you charm the, or inveigle the babushka? I mean, that must have been like...
You just get used to being sort of told what to do. And then you just have to say like, oh, спасибо. Like, thank you so much for helping me, you know, clean my private parts or whatever. You know, I mean,
they're
just
examining my own self-illusions.
And you just have to, you know, they're very, like, I remember, you know, some days it would be sort of unseasonably warm. So I'd take off a layer and they were always like, no, you dress for the season. Not, they don't care if it's actually warm that day. The point is if it's still, you know, February, you have to wear X number of, you know, so it's like, oh God.
Yeah.
Very opinionated. Women are really opinionated.
In 2007, you were named one of the stars of tomorrow by New York Magazine. I realize could be a sensitive issue, but I am curious. I mean, how do you go about your writing life when someone has deemed you a star of tomorrow like that? I mean, do you sort of ignore it, or do you have a responsibility to live up to that? I mean, that's a lot of debut novelists don't have the star of tomorrow attached, like some sort of booming voice from above.
Star of tomorrow sounds, you know,
or Star Search, I guess.
God, it sounds awful, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That was really paralyzing for me. Actually, for about a year, I could hardly write anything.
Jesus.
And, but it's funny. I think this is probably just partly the way my psychology is, because I was joking with I'm chummy with a couple of the other people who were in that little thing, and one of them, I was joking with one of them, and he said, "Oh, are you kidding? Like, that was such a, you know, for him it was inspiring and it like got him going, and for me it just made me feel like it was so much pressure. I felt like a fraud. I felt like it wasn't good enough. It was so arbitrary." So yeah, for me it was paralyzing. I mean, it was such a silly thing, really, because you know, they just had this idea to ask the heads of the writing programs in and around New York to each sort of suggest a student that they thought had chops or something. And so, you know, it wasn't like New York Magazine picked these people. It was like in each program, you know, Joyce Carol has picked someone at Princeton, and, you know, Ben Marcus picked someone at Columbia, and Michael Cunningham, who was my teacher and mentor at Brooklyn College, suggested me. And I don't know why he suggested me. You know, I don't, the whole thing feels so arbitrary. I feel like if it had been a different week, he might have picked someone else. Do you know what I mean? I never for a moment thought like, oh, this means I've arrived. This means I always understood how arbitrary it was.
But it gave you additional pressure to turn out a book or something like that?
It did feel like additional pressure. It also, but in the good thing about it was it sort of made me take myself a little more seriously, because I suddenly had these agents emailing me, and I, you know, at that stage was just graduating from the MFA program, you know, had a few finished short stories, but was really not even close to having a manuscript, you know, and I had really a rough idea for a novel, but I mean, I hadn't even started writing a novel, so it was way too soon to be getting hyped, because I didn't have anything. But on the other hand, I'm the kind of person who might never have queried an agent on my own, because I'm like, assume I'm going to get rejected, you know what I mean? So it probably in a way helped that they came to me, because
that's the only way you're actually going to finish something?
Well, no, I might have finished something, but I just think I don't know. I don't think I ever would have had the nerve to query some of the agents who contacted me. You know what I mean? I just don't think it would ever have occurred to me that they would be willing to read my work. So
it seems to me that it actually was helpful, and maybe you needed that boost to get your ass in gear.
Yeah, or I don't know. Not in terms of the writing. I was doing the writing, but I think
getting published, going into that soul sausage factory.
Right. The business side of it intimidated me, you know, and I think I would have spent a lot more time just writing quietly by myself and assuming that no one really wanted to read my stuff. And this was, you know, suddenly these agents who I was like, wait, you represent like all these writers I love, like you actually want to read my stuff. You know, it was kind of like, really? And so, you know, they were taking me seriously. So suddenly I had to take myself more seriously. And so, yes, in that sense, I think if that hadn't happened, well, I mean, I you know, I found my agent that way. It did kind of make me feel like, oh, maybe I have the right to do this, you know?
Mm-hmm. So it seems to me like, so you're suffering from imposter syndrome in some way?
That I think most people do. I mean, I think most writers, or really anyone in the arts, has those feelings of like, am I a fraud? Am I, you know, you used to sort of constantly doubt yourself. I mean, I'm actually suspicious of people who don't doubt themselves on some level. So, yeah, but I'm also just generally uncomfortable with the idea of fame. I don't like this culture where we're sort of more interested in the, you know, talking about the writer or the personality rather than the book. You know what I mean? And I'm uncomfortable with the word star, you know, like, what does that mean? You know, I want to talk about the books, you know what I mean? So
I've been flitting, I think, back and forth between that. So hopefully we've struck an acceptable balance.
You know, and I also, I think I'm very aware of the fact that as a debut novelist who's female, you know, you get sort of sold a certain way. Like, you know, of course publishing is like excited if a female writer is photogenic. And
you've had issues of whether you're photogenic or not.
No, I know I'm photogenic. I mean, I'm also aware that there are probably other writers who resent me because they think, well, maybe there are things that you get just because you look a certain way or you know, present well or something.
Or you have connections with Michael Cunningham or whatnot.
Well, that I feel like that is like, you know, that's a ludicrous thing to be complaining about because I applied to that MFA program the same way anyone else did. It's not like I, you know, some nepotism got me into an MFA program and then, you know, but I mean, I'm friends with him because he was my teacher. And,
sure.
And then he became a friend, you know.
But resentment comes from people who don't have what you have and can never have what you have and often, in many cases, don't know how to find it within find what they want within themselves. So why pay these vulping types any kind of heat?
No, I know. It's not worth thinking about. But I just know, you know how it is in the publishing world. There's a lot of kind of, in any particular world, the art world's the same way. You get this kind of weird resentments that build up. And I'm really grateful that my book is getting published, even though I have moments where I think, oh, I wish I could rewrite certain parts of it. And I am really grateful that I'm, you know, doing the thing that I have always loved doing most, which is writing fiction. And I'm really excited to try to make the next book better. And, you know, I mean, I feel very lucky, but I'm also, you know, that whole sort of who's a star, is this person a star? Like, that thing just makes me crazy because I just think that's silly.
You don't have to pay attention to that
crap. No, I know. Yeah. But anyway, so I'm grateful to New York Magazine. I'm grateful to Michael. I'm great, you know, in the long run, it was more good than bad, but it did make me very uncomfortable at the time, and it just sort of all these things about it made me uncomfortable. This idea that, you know, you could sort of pick certain people to be star. I mean, it's just
you still feel that you're a star in some sense that's being propelled by a certain.
No. That's what I mean. I don't feel like a star at all. But I have a problem with that word in any way. I mean, I would rather have certain books get sort of singled out. It's like, wow, this book is really, you know, but this idea of labeling the writers of books stars, it seems like really problematic to me. Like, I'm just not, I don't know. That I just don't like the whole sort of celebrity culture, I guess. Yeah. And like, do we really need it in literature? No.
Yeah. Why can't the celebrity culture be attached to singing the praises of the book and leaving the author out of the equation altogether? Sort of.
Yeah, kind of. Huh. I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
So, but I understand we just live in a world in which people want to have a face attached to the, you know, remember when the first time the New Yorker actually published photographs of their 20 under, you know, that I remember that was such a kind of shocking thing to have all these photos. And I remember feeling really torn about it. You know, I can still see all those pictures in my mind. And I, on the one hand, of course, was like sort of poring over them, like, oh, how fascinating. But I was also kind of upset, you know, I didn't want it to be, I didn't even really want to think about that. You know, I didn't want to.
On the other hand, the unctuous marketing type will argue with you, well, if you walk down the street, there are people with their phones, they're photographing everything, they're uploading things to Instagram, and you can't get away from it.
No, no, I completely, that's what I mean. That's what I mean. I just, this is the culture we live in. I completely, I get it, and I understand that, you know, that people honestly are probably more likely to buy a book if they have a sense of what the writer is like. And I understand all that. I just, you know, it's just something that I feel uncomfortable with.
Is it something we can combat in any way? I'm actually on the same page here.
Probably not, but I just, you know, I'm very grateful if people read my book and I'm happy to talk about the book itself, but I just, you know, I have had people, a couple people say to me, like, oh, you're really blowing up. And I'm like, what does that mean? You know, what does that mean? And also, that does not change anything, really. I'm still the same person, you know? Yeah. If my book...
You're not an inflatable doll. That's what I'm pretty sure.
I'm not. I still, quote, unquote, blowing up is not going to solve my existential angst. It's not gonna, you know, cure my frequent bouts of insomnia.
And it's, you know, it's not gonna take the Hindenburg disaster out of our minds.
It's not gonna make me stop worrying about North Korea and, you know, nuclear war. So
you wanna talk about blowing up.
Right, exactly.
That's how I would actually but like I'm to bumped, use that.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yes. So anyway, I'm I think I have a healthy skepticism about all that stuff. I guess what I'm saying. So I'm really grateful to be, you know, writing, and that's what I care about. But I can't sort of care when there's all the kerfuffle of, you know, everyone was like, why is there a picture of such and such author in Times Square? I don't care. You know what I mean?
Like, you don't wear vests.
Well, I don't care you know what I mean. I just sort of feel like, well, okay, if a publisher feels like that's going to help sell the book, fine. Don't take it out on the author. I mean, I guess that's what I don't understand when there ends up being this kind of hostility towards certain authors who get really heavily marketed in some way. You know, because it's like, well, it really, the market stuff has nothing to do with the author. It really doesn't. It's like, you can't, if someone gets a big advance, for example, it's not so much, oh, this book is better than that book, it means the publishers know how to sell that book. It means they think they can get a good return on their investment, you know? So it's, and that has more to do with, you know, whatever happens to be sort of doing well. And, you know, it's so beyond our control that I think even thinking about it is a waste of time. So I never understand the kind of knee-jerk hostility towards a writer who gets a big advance or who gets a lot of, press or something. I just think, really? I mean,
the hostility should be there if the writer writes a bad book.
Well, but even then, no, why be hostile to the writer? It's like, each writer is doing the best he or she can to write a book, right? So it's like, you can read a book and say, I think this is awful. I don't understand why publisher X paid so much money for this. But even then, why would you take it out on the author? The author just did his or her best to write a book, and if someone decided to pay them a lot of money for it, it's like, you know, complain about the game, but I just don't understand the, I don't understand the kind of hating of writers. I just don't get it. It's like, we're all trying to do the same thing. We're all like alone in a room doing this thing, which most of the time is really difficult, you know? So I think we're all on the same side. We all love books. So I think everyone's doing the best they can. I just don't understand the attacks.
And I know, and we've gotten into this on Twitter, this issue before, you and me, but here's the thing. If a writer writes a terrible book, and that terrible book gets about 10 times as much coverage as a great book, which is getting no coverage at all, don't you feel a certain amount of justifiable hostility?
Not towards the writer. It has nothing to do with the writer. I mean, the writer, and P.S., you know, someone might not think it is a terrible book. You know, it's, I mean, these things are pretty subjective. And the writer he or she presumably did the best job they could with that book. So if that book happens to be getting a lot of attention, it actually, it's not his or her fault. It's like, for whatever reason, you know, maybe there's an amazing publicist, or maybe the agent is just super connected. You know, something happens that, you know, this book ends up everywhere, but taking it on the writer, I mean, I don't know. It just seems like a total waste of time to me, because the writer doesn't control these things. Like, you just can't predict, you know, if you have no, and it's also, a lot of it has to do with, you know, if a book comes out and something about the book resonates with the zeitgeist, well, the book is going to get talked about a lot more, just because people have things to say about it, you know? So again, it doesn't have much to do with the book at all. It has to do with sort of the climate in which it comes out. So no, I don't think hostility toward the writer is ever justified. I don't get it. I really don't get it.
Another day is gone. I'm still all alone. How could this be? You're not here with me. You never said goodbye.